Robert Abrams became a crusading attorney general of New York from 1979 to 1993. As a reformer, he battled political machine bosses and special interests, winning landmark victories for consumers, protecting the environment, and a woman's right to choose. He led attorneys general across the nation to protect the right of all Americans. He tells about his time in politics. He refers to it as my journey in politics in his new book, The Luckiest Guy in the World. And it's a great pleasure to welcome that lucky guy to our program. Bob Abrams, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. It's actually my pleasure to be with you and with your listeners today. Thanks a lot for your invitation.
Very nice to have you on the program. We've all been, I think all of us Albanyites, have been looking forward to this book for some time. You were such a fixture here, and I'm curious as to, given that the end of your attorney general career was in 1993, of why now to say, okay, I'd like to tell my story of what I did in that time?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very legitimate question. I always wanted to write a book, and I never got around to it. And of course, I've been telling myself, boy, it would have been a lot easier if I did it during the time that I was there and as attorney general. But actually what happened, so as the years went by, you know, I never did it. I thought I would want to do it, but then my two daughters grew up and they got married and they had kids, and I now have 8 grandchildren. And so there came a time a few years ago, where I realized that my grandchildren were born after I left public life. And so I figured, you know, maybe I should leave them some notes about what life was like for me. So I worked with an oral historian, a brilliant guy, Jerry Alberelli, who teaches oral history at Columbia University, and he started asking me questions, encouraged me to talk into a computer microphone, and then he'd give me transcripts, and I'd revise them, I'd edit them. And after a while, it started to pile up and looked like possibly a book. So that's how it got started, and that got converted into and he started probing me, digging deep into my memory, and then we had to go back to records and really pull together, you know, different strains of my life and career and what we did as AG. And there she is, and I really do feel I am the luckiest guy in the world, you know, for a whole bunch of reasons.
Letitia James, the current Attorney General of New York State, in the introduction to the book, writes about you: Robert Abrams was larger than life. His legacy was manifest not only in New York but across the nation. As the former president of the National Association of Attorneys General, his scholarship and influence loomed over the office. The book on you, beside your own, is that you transformed that office, that you came in and made that office, which has in many quarters been referred to as sleepy and backwater, and made it something that was very important. I would like you to reflect on that. Obviously, I assume you're not overly conscious of that as you're doing it, but now in reflecting and writing about it, of what you were able to do in that time that fits that bill that the current AG describes.
Okay, so look, any attorney general comes into office, stands on the shoulders of his predecessors, those who came before. And I came after Louis Lefkowitz, who had been in that office for 22 years. He was a Republican liberal. I was the first Democrat elected attorney general in 40 years. That shocks a lot of people when they hear that. And Lefkowitz, you know, there was a sort of a revolution was beginning in the 60s and 70s. And Lefkowitz in New York was part of that. In fact, if not even a leader in starting to do some things affirmatively, because the attorney general always had, for the 200-year history of the office, just the defensive role to defend the state whenever the state is sued. And so there began to be the launching of some offensive efforts, suing companies that discriminated against people for civil rights violations or to protect consumers or protect the environment. And there, you know, he created an environmental bureau and had some very good lawyers in that bureau to start some important initiatives. And then I got elected, and it so happened that it was also during the period of Ronald Reagan, who had a political philosophy of laissez-faire, get the government off the back of business, and he put the watchdog to sleep. So the consumer protector, the protector of people's human rights and the environment, was put to sleep. No one at the federal level was doing anything. And so, you know, I had the privilege of serving at that time, and I became president of the National Association of Attorneys General, and I had a good personal relationship with AGs across the country, and I respected them, even if they came from smaller states or they were members of the Republican Party. You know, there was mutual respect, and we said, why don't we collaborate together? Let's start to have lawsuits with common investigations, and in fact that led into multi-state investigations and multi-state prosecutions into huge cases that had a very significant impact involving large numbers of people, systemic problems, returning millions, hundreds of millions of dollars to the pocketbooks of consumers who were defrauded. You know, people felt overpowered that they couldn't deal with the government, private sector abuse, you know, polluting the environment. How can a single individual fight a big, powerful corporate polluter? Well, attorneys general allied with individuals and community groups can do that. And so, you know, one of the exciting things, Joe, about the Office of Attorney General is that it's malleable. The office can be molded. It can be shaped into the image of whoever is the attorney general at any point in time. And so, for better or for worse, the people of New York elected me as an activist. They knew my background as a member of the state assembly and a borough president of the Bronx, and I was an activist, and I saw government as an ally of the people. And so I began to recruit and attract people who had the same vision that I did. Let's go and utilize the power of the law to protect the public interest and people's rights. And so I was surrounded by very dedicated and talented people. They did not punch a time clock. They came in early. They stayed late. They worked weekends. And we began to bring lawsuits that had major impact. For example, the area of the environment, Love Canal.
Right.
Before I became attorney general, then the state never went to court to clean up a toxic waste site. And by the time I left, we brought 65 lawsuits causing companies to clean up. And what does that mean? I mean, people were living in terror in local communities that their water supply was being contaminated. Aquifers were being polluted by chemicals that were being placed in the ground. They just don't sit there. They move and they contaminate the water supply. Pregnant women are worried that the progeny that the children are about to bring into the world might be poisoned as a result of it. So what an opportunity given to me. And so I loved every day that I was in that office, and I tried my best to maximize it for the benefit of people.
In reading the book, and just in that chapter alone on Love Canal, it's fascinating to me because there's a duality to the job. There is the lawyering, and then there is also the politician. And you seem to enjoy both.
Yeah, and it was a challenge for me because, you know, the Office of Attorney General, I mean, I wanted it to be the best. I wanted to have a meritocracy. You get hired in this office based upon your credentials, not based upon who you know politically, not based upon patronage considerations. And it was fantastically exciting to me to see this flood of resumes constantly coming in of people who wanted to work in the AG's office, who had great credentials, who came from terrific not-for-profit organizations championing the rights of consumers and protecting the environment. And, I mean, this to me was a very moving thing. Lawyers leaving the private sector, comfortably ensconced in a law firm, earning big bucks, major dollars, taking maybe a third of the salary that they were earning to come to work in the Attorney General's office to fight the cause of the people and the public interest. So it was a demanding job. You know, you had to have the vision of how to set priorities for the office. You had to have the courage to take on some important battles. You had to be a good office manager to make sure that this big office was running effectively and smoothly, and that you were attracting good people, and that the proper decisions were made. And so, you know, it was a great time for me. I mean, it was very thrilling, and to work, you know, and I couldn't do it alone. It had with these hundreds of people with all kinds serving in all kinds of roles, whether they were paralegals, whether it was with secretarial support or other lawyers, or lawyers who were promoted to be managers, division heads and bureau chiefs and section heads and people. We converted the office in part to be a criminal protector where possible. We went to the legislature and for the first time got the authority for the Attorney General to prosecute laws criminally for those who with criminal intent were endangering people's lives by poisoning the environment. They could be prosecuted. And for the first time, we impaneled our own grand juries in our own office. And so it was a terrific time. And I try to give the readers some sense of that by you know, giving them the chapters of the book.
The name of the new book is The Luckiest Guy in the World, and it is by Robert Abrams, who joins us this morning, former New York Attorney General. I mentioned duality a moment ago. Talk about working in the macro, the Reagan era, but in the micro, working in New York State, which obviously is more liberal, is more progressive, and you also were there for most, if not all, of the Cuomo administration of Mario Cuomo. So talk about that partnership, if you will, if that's the correct word to use.
Yeah. So look, I mean, I was the first Democrat elected in 40 years to be Attorney General. And every time I ran, I got a bigger slice of the vote. You know, I was an independent, a reform-minded guy, so I had primaries in all the races I ever had for the assembly, for borough president, for attorney general. I was challenged by the party machine. And so I had to have a broad base of support, and I try to work hard to earn that support. You know, I was from New York City. I was from the Bronx. The people of New York State is a huge state, New York. 62 counties spread over hundreds of miles. The city of Jamestown is closer to the capital of Ohio than it is to the capital of New York in Albany. And so I had to travel. I made a commitment to myself and to the people. I said, you know, I'm going to work hard, and I'm going to have you get to know me, and I'm going to get to know you. And so I made a commitment to visit every single county in the state during the time I was Attorney General. And so people got to know me, and I wanted them to know what my agenda was and what kind of a person I was. And then I said, look, you're entitled to have the Attorney General's office touch you. And although we had just a handful of network of regional offices in Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, Watertown, Utica, Poughkeepsie, Albany, one out in Long Island, New York, with its 62 counties, you couldn't have an office in every single county. So I created the concept. Actually, I got an idea from an upstater, a guy named John Sullivan from upstate New York, outside of Syracuse. He said, Bob, why don't you have, you know, an assistant from your regional offices visit neighboring counties in the smaller counties on a regular and fixed basis every month, every Monday or every Thursday from 1 to 5. Somebody would come to the county clerk's office. It didn't require any extra money or funding. It just was an innovative idea. So to implement an agenda, to run an office, to get along with elected officials, town, village, city, county elected officials, Democrats, Republicans, it was a huge challenge to get along with the federal government, to cooperate, and when necessary, to stand up against the federal government, to fight for the rights of your own citizens. So we began to bring major lawsuits, you know, in the Reagan era, when rights were being denied, when there was retreat, when federal laws were not being enforced, and Actually, that was a carryover and a spillover to the current day, because during the Trump administration, there was a retrenchment. You did not have strong enforcement of the environmental laws, of civil rights laws, of consumer protection. And so attorneys general did during the Trump era what I was able to do during the Reagan era, cooperate with other attorneys general, bringing multi-state investigations and multi-state lawsuits. So, again, very demanding, very challenging, but certainly very rewarding.
And the other part of that question of the relationship with Mario Cuomo.
Oh, okay. So I served with two governors. I got elected when Hugh Carey was governor of the state, and when Mario Cuomo was governor of the state. And this really answers, it's a fascinating question that you're leading up to, Joe, because in most states in America, the attorney general is elected by the people. The attorney general started out at the outset in all states being appointed. But as constitutional conventions began to be convened in the 1800s, they shifted from an appointed attorney general to an elected attorney general. And only in a handful of states now do you have an appointed attorney general. Most of them are small states, Hawaii, Alaska, New Hampshire, Wyoming. There is a big state that has an appointed attorney general, and that's New Jersey. And there are two states that are real outliers. Maine has the legislature every 2 years elect the attorney general. And in Tennessee, it's the Supreme Court who selects an attorney general for a fixed term of 8 years. So the attorney general in New York is independent, elected by the people, and owes the allegiance to the people. And so it's this challenge, because you serve the people and yet you enforce the laws of the state, and you have as your clients the agencies of state government, and the head of those agencies are appointed by the governor. So sometimes there is tension between a governor and an attorney general. And sometimes that happens, and it doesn't matter whether the governor is a member of your own party or of a different party. So that's one of the challenges of being the attorney general, taking that oath of office, adhering to that oath, doing your job, and it's got a dual role. I mean, and a lot of people don't understand this too, that the visibility of the office is on the offensive side, the affirmative side. The attorney general brings a lawsuit and collects money, gets refunds for consumers, brings a lawsuit to clean up the environment, and some company does that. But two-thirds of the lawyers in the attorney general's office are assigned to defensive cases. They're defending the people of the state of New York, the state of New York, the treasury of the state, against lawsuits that are brought against the state. You know, somebody trips and falls on the pavement of State University. Some professor feels that they didn't get to be the chairman of the department because they allege that their civil rights were being violated. The person didn't get it because she was a woman. The person didn't get it because she was handicapped. If somebody says, I didn't get it because of my religious background or racial background, there's a contractor who builds a courthouse for the state, and there's a fight with the state how much money is owed to that contractor. So there are these, you know, the legislature passes laws and somebody challenges the constitutionality of the statute. So you have the attorney general defending the state and at the same time going on the offense to launch lawsuits, launch investigations, advocate legislation, testifying before Congress. I mean, you know, nowhere in the state constitution or the statutes does it say the attorney general should travel to Washington, D.C. to testify before Congress. And I think I did that like 35 times to advocate and tell the Congress they should be passing laws to help better protect the people, not only of my own state, but people across the country. So it's a fabulous office. And I've heard people say, whether it was Walter Mondale, who was the vice president of the United States, he was the attorney general of Minnesota, and he became United States senator. He became vice president. He tried to run for president and lost against Ronald Reagan. But he said it was the best job that he ever had in his life. Actually, Bill Clinton said that. He was the attorney general of Arkansas. But I suspect that president of the United States is a little better than
the
attorney general.
You think, I mentioned the current Attorney General, Letitia James, who wrote the foreword to your book, And you think of, well, what she's doing right now in investigating the governor of the state of New York, and how hard that must be on her, how hard it must be on the office, and yet that is the job.
You're absolutely right. And it highlights some of the things that we've been talking about, the various different roles that the attorney general plays. And I think Tish James has been a fabulous attorney general, maintaining the high quality tradition of that office, launching important lawsuits, particularly in the era of Trump. And in this situation, when the right thing was demanded of her, to say this governor, there are these serious allegations of sexual harassment, and they can't be swept under the rug. They deserve to be investigated, and they got to be investigated properly. You know, there were efforts to try to have, the attorney general not do it alone, to share the responsibility, right, to have somebody else do it. But there was Attorney General Tish James standing up strong, courageously, firm, saying, no, this is the role under the executive law for the attorney general to do this, to launch this investigation, and I intend to do it, and I need the full subpoena power to give to the people I designate and appoint to do this investigation. And, I commend her for doing the right thing here, as she has done so far throughout her term.
My final question for you, Bob, is we talk a lot about gridlock. We talk about polarization in politics. We talk about getting good leaders and who wants to run for office. Given the time that has gone by since you held elected office, how do you feel? How do you, or and as AG, of course, how do you feel about how times have changed? Are we in a different place right now than we were? Would your job have been massively different if it were today?
We're obviously at a different time and place, and we just went through, in my view, in my humble view, a horrendous period. I mean, I was apoplectic during the term of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
I thought that our constitutional values are being challenged. The whole history of the office, the independence of the Justice Department, the Attorney General's role, what he was doing on a daily basis, the unfortunate lies that were being told to the American people. And so it creates, for a lot of folks in the society, a lot of cynicism. And you have to deal with that cynicism. And of course, the big lie that he won the election when 60 to 70 judges all across the country, a lot of them appointed by him, including the Supreme Court with the unanimous rulings, with three appointees appointed by him, all certifying, to the election and saying that the election must stand. There can be a lot of cynicism. There always was about government and politics. There are stories in the newspaper, stories in the press about those who betray the public trust. But I'm a positivist, and I think it's very important for this democracy to involve the largest possible numbers of people and to give a message, send a message to our youth, because they contain, the energy, the enthusiasm, the hope for tomorrow, the idealism to help clean up the system. We can't afford to have them drop out. We have to have them roll up their sleeves and get involved. And I think one of the messages from the book is that we need you, and come on in. Don't drop out. Don't turn your back. And don't feel that you can't do it. My dad and mom, they ran a candy store. My father never went to college. In fact, he never graduated from high school. He had to drop out of high school to help his parents earn a living to provide for the family. When I ran for the assembly, I was 2 years out of law school. I didn't have a lot of money. I didn't know the right people. I didn't come from a powerful cluster. And yet, gee whiz, I was able to win. I won my insurgent race for the assembly, and I won for borough president and attorney general. So there is hope out there. And yes, today it's the same as in the past, where there's a degree of cynicism, and maybe the cynicism, because we're so divided on so many levels, is more intense today. But the demand is there for people to participate, to get involved, especially our young, because, again, I believe the cup is half full and not half empty, and that there's always a better tomorrow for this, the greatest country, you know, on earth today.
Great words to end with. The name of the new book, The Luckiest Guy in the World, My Journey in Politics. The book is by Robert Abrams. It is published by Skyhorse. Bob, thanks so much for being with us. What a pleasure to speak with you. I so appreciate
Likewise.
Your time.
Joe, thanks so much, and you're kind to extend the invitation. Thanks a lot.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the new book is The Luckiest Guy in the World, My Journey in Politics. Robert Abrams is the author. It's published by Skyhorse. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.